This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're out tromping around in Vermont and you come across an area of land, say a half acre or more, that looks like the ground has been shaped by waves, sort of undulating, you might be seeing the lasting effects of a hurricane that hit our region nearly 80 years ago. When the hurricane of 1938 made landfall, it tore through New England. It destroyed roads, bridges, and buildings. It caused massive flooding in coastal areas, and it killed hundreds of people. It also uprooted millions of trees in Vermont and New Hampshire. Those undulations in the landscape around Vermont were caused by trees getting ripped from the ground and falling. They left behind big pits where the roots were torn out, taking rocks and soil with them. You might be able to fit a car in some of these pits. And the mounds are from the decomposition of the roots and stump over the years. Our guest today has spent decades looking at Vermont forests and became fascinated with the effects of this massive hurricane on our landscape, so fascinated that he wrote a book about the storm. Stephen Long is the author of 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England, and he joins us today to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you so much, Jane.
The hurricane actually arrived in September of 1938. What was actually known about it before it made landfall? Were people prepared for this huge storm?
Well, that was one of the reasons that it was so destructive, was that nobody had any idea that it was coming. And that's in two senses. First of all, there had never, ever been a hurricane that came to New England up this far north. Vermont.
I think it still remains the only actual hurricane to make land, to hit Vermont as a hurricane.
As
right?
A hurricane with 100-mile-an-hour winds. So we've had hurricanes since then that have come and that have dumped a lot of water on us, but this was the one that came with wind. So Vermont had no history with hurricanes, but New England in general had very, very little in the 60 or 70 years preceding the hurricane. So even coastal New England was not at all ready for this. Two generations had passed since anybody in New England had experienced a hurricane. So we've had, it was something that hurricanes happen in Florida, hurricanes happen in the Gulf. They do not happen in New England. So in general, there was just no historical memory of hurricanes. They were not ready. They weren't thinking of it. Second of all, the hurricane had scared forecasters down south. Florida braced for it. They were all set for a big, big storm. They knew it was a big storm. And the forecasters did a terrific job of alerting people to the possible danger of this. And they did such a good job that the ships at sea, who normally are the one way that people can know about a hurricane, they would radio back to the weather service. There were no ships in the area of the hurricane. So when the hurricane turned and headed north, no one was there to know this was happening. And so there's a standard pattern of hurricanes that has played out many, many times where it recurves to the northeast. It heads north and then it heads northeast. And that's because the weather systems across the continent blow things out to sea. They expected that to happen. Nobody knew that this was coming due north, and nobody knew that it was going to be as devastating as it was.
And again, this was 1938, which is before the official naming policy for hurricanes started. So this storm doesn't have a proper name like Katrina or Irene or Sandy.
Right, right.
But it does sometimes, I understand, have the nickname the Long Island Express. And
right.
That's partly because that's where it made landfall, right?
It made landfall in Long Island. And the express part is that it was fast. It was a 50-mile-an-hour it moved at 50 miles an hour, which is really, really fast for a hurricane. Normally, they poke along, and you can chart them for days and days, and you can see where it's going. And you know, today we look on IntelliCast or the Weather Channel, and we just know where a hurricane is, and we see that it takes time to get here. Irene took days to get here. 38. It came, it hit Long Island, and it spent 4 or 5 hours and was gone. Any place that it hit, it came and went in 5 hours.
We're talking about the hurricane of 1938. Maybe you have stories about it from your family's experience in New England, or maybe you have old trees on your property that have a distinct kink in them where they were felled and then managed to survive and grew straight up after that. We'd love to hear your stories about the hurricane of 1938 or any questions you might have for our guest, Stephen Long, who wrote the book 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. If you'd like to share your thoughts or questions, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Steve, how big was this storm? What was the damage like?
The damage, it's still the most damaging storm in New England history. So it at the time, in $1938, it cost $300 million to make the necessary repairs. That would translate to $5 billion today. So it was a $5 billion storm then. And you think if there was a repeat of that today, people estimate that it would be more like a $40 billion storm because there are so many more people in the area in the footprint of that storm today. So there is about 8 million people in the region in 1938. There's 17 million now. Plus, we're living out in rural areas that haven't been lived in a long, long time since the peak of agriculture. So there's roads that are going out that have power lines, telephone lines, way, way deep into the woods. And we also have many, many more trees. So at the time, Vermont was about 50-55% forested, and a lot of that forest was young. Today we're 80% forested, and the trees are mature. And the taller, the more mature a tree, the more chance of it going down.
Some of the stats on the storm, it sounds like it killed something like 680 people, damaged or destroyed 57,000 homes. As you mentioned, $300 million in losses in 1938 money. And we got a note from Sylvia in Lindenville who said she's sending these notes on the 38 hurricane that she found jotted down in an old notebook. 250 million trees were damaged by the storm. In Vermont, 20% of the sugar maple trees were blown down. The force of the waves pounding on the New England shore was recorded on a seismograph in Sitka, Alaska. 125-mile-an-hour winds forced water in Narragansett Bay up the narrow Providence River and flooded downtown Providence, Rhode Island, to a depth of 10 feet in minutes. Does that all jive with what you found in your research?
More or less. The numbers seem about right. I've heard 16 feet in downtown Providence.
Wow.
The damage to the coast is really tremendous, and the loss of life there is primarily because of the storm surge. So this was a tidal wave that came and just sucked houses out into the Long Island Sound, Connecticut and Rhode Island. Rhode Island in particular, 400 people in Rhode Island died. And so it was just a tremendous, tremendous loss down there. Infrastructure ripped apart, bridges, roads. Everything that has been written so far about the storm has focused on that area, and rightly so. I mean, that's a tremendous, tremendous loss of life, tremendous damage. But I felt that it was ignored what's happened up this way, and the fact that it was truly the only hurricane that's ever hit Vermont with 100-mile-an-hour winds, that story needed to be told.
So what did happen in Vermont and New Hampshire, this part of New England?
So essentially the track of the storm bisected the state with a slightly curve to the northwest. So it came in right about in the Green Mountains and headed up over to Burlington, and then it continued on into Canada. But the damage pattern is that track is really crucial for that, because to the right-hand side, to the east of that track, most of the damage was from wind. To the west of the track, most of the damage was from rain. And the reason for that is that there's a cyclonic rotation of a hurricane, and so it's a counterclockwise flow of air. So the storm is coming along at 50 miles an hour. If there was no cyclonic rotation, you would have a 50 mile an hour wind from the south. On the right hand side of that, you have the rotation, the counterclockwise, and that's rotating at another 50 miles an hour. And so on the right hand side, you combine the rotation with the forward momentum. On the west side, it more or less cancels itself out, and so it's rain on that side.
And that's how you get the gusts of 100 mile an hour winds coming into the state.
So it was sustained winds of 100 miles an hour and gusts probably at 150.
And we didn't have the loss of life like you saw in places like Rhode Island where there was so much flood damage. But we still had a lot of damage in this state from those winds.
Yeah. So trees were down everywhere, street trees, yard trees, across every road in Vermont. It wasn't every mile of road that needed to be cleared, but you know, it had to have been 75% of the. I mean, it was very few places were spared, and so if it wasn't the wind damage, it was flooding. The flooding in Brandon, Bristol, Rutland was just terrible. On the other side, there was trees down everywhere, and especially in the forest. I think in your intro you talked about the sugar bushes, and so the sugar makers lost a tremendous amount of their sugar orchards. Those sugar orchards tend to be on the ridges. If that ridge faced to the south or the southeast, boom, it was down. If it faced to the north or the northwest, it might have been in the lee. It might have escaped. But as you know, Vermont has just tremendous topography. So there's a lot of places that are very vulnerable and other places that are not so much.
Let's go to the phone. Sister Lorian is calling in from Berlin. Hi, Sister Lorian. Go ahead.
Hello. I was out in the storm.
Oh.
I was 4 months old. And a tree blew down in front of the car my mother was driving with me in the front seat.
Wow.
So that's the first thing that I have about the storm. This was in Massachusetts. We were living on a farm, and we had a spring. And I know that we used the spring for our refrigerator for quite a while.
Huh.
Wow.
That's my take on 38.
That's a great story.
Yeah, Sister Lorian, I imagine you don't remember being in the front seat of the car as a baby, but amazing that you have this history with the storm of 1938. Did you find in your family it was something that continued to be talked about through your childhood and beyond?
Yes, whenever there was a hurricane, we remembered 38.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate your story. Let's go to Glenn, who's calling in from Orange, Massachusetts. Hi, Glenn. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I'm a forester since I've been 18. I'm 62 now. I've been a forester. And the hurricane in 1938 is a big deal for me.
Why?
Who was your guest here?
Stephen Long just wrote a book about it. Steve Long. Steve Long is his name, yeah.
Okay, Steve. You've read about this hurricane, right?
I've read everything that's written.
David M. Smith?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah. He was my major professor.
Well, you're a lucky man. He was a brilliant man.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, and he wrote his PhD thesis on that hurricane, right?
So, Glenn, it sounds like that had a major influence on you becoming a forester. Thank you so much for calling in. Steve, tell us a little bit about who this man is that had such an influence on Glenn and knew so much about the storm.
Well, David Smith was sort of the dean of foresters in New England. And as Glenn said, he wrote his dissertation on the 38 hurricane and its effect on forests. He had a textbook that was the textbook that every forester studied from, and so most New England foresters would have gone through either, if not individually with him as a professor, they would know his book.
We are talking about the storm of 38, the hurricane that blew through and, as we've just been talking about, really devastated much of New England, including just ripping apart the forests in Vermont. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, what happened to the forests here, and what happened with all of that timber that was felled and the economic impacts, as well as what you can still see today, the lasting effects of the storm of 38. And if you have a story to share or a question for Stephen Long, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking about a long-ago weather event with lasting effects. Stephen Long is the author of 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. He's sharing his knowledge of how the storm did just that, especially here in Vermont, where the devastation to our forests was remarkable. If you have a question or an experience to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note for everyone to see on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Arthur, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Arthur. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm old enough to have remembered the hurricane. In fact, I'll be turning 84 tomorrow.
Congratulations.
At the time, I was living in White Plains, New York, and of course, we didn't get the direct brunt. That was Long Island, but I recall waking up that morning after the storm, having listened to the wind howling fiercely outside, to discover that a huge oak tree across the street had been completely uprooted. Now, this oak tree must have been at least a couple hundred years old, and the intensity of the wind still remains in my memory after all these years.
Arthur, Sister Lorien said that whenever another hurricane appeared on the horizon in her family, they would talk about 38. Does that resonate for you? Do you think about 38 when new storms come up?
Oh, yes. Often, as you pointed out before, they weren't named at the time. They had no name. But I was only six, so we talked about it for some time, but it didn't remain a constant item of conversation. But when I heard you were doing the piece this morning, because I've been actually writing about that, I had a whole paragraph in front of me that I was writing a bit of a memoir, and that's one of the items that crept into this memoir that I've been working on. So I was more than a little surprised and pleased when I heard you were going to be covering this topic.
Arthur, what serendipity, and thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience, and happy birthday tomorrow. Let's take another call from Jim in Unity, New Hampshire. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was 3 years old in 1938. Are you hearing me?
Yes, we've got you loud and clear.
Good. My family owned a tract of land in western Massachusetts, the town of Pelham, near Amherst. And I, of course, don't really have personal memories of what happened when I was 3 years old, but it was a big thing in my family. And one of the very vivid memories I have is of all the white pine trees that went down in the hurricane of 38, and this still happens. Pine trees, the white pine is a very shallow rooted tree, and when it goes over, the whole root structure stands vertical like a wall. And I remember seeing many of those trees when I was a child in the town of Pelham, Massachusetts. And you can still see on the tract of land where I live now in Unity, there are a number of trees that have gone over in lesser storms recently, and I can see that same thing. The thing you can also see is the woods in this part of the world tend to have a rather uneven surface to them, and some of that comes from trees like that going over, lifting a whole bunch of dirt up on their roots, which eventually falls down, and leaving a sort of a pit on the other side.
Yeah, Jim, thank you so much for sharing your memories and stories. And that gets us right into what we wanted to talk about with Stephen Long here, about the lasting impact on the landscape and what happened when all of those trees were uprooted in our areas. Thank you so much for calling in, Jim. And Steve, pick it up there, because this is what we were talking about earlier, these undulations in the landscape that are still visible from the storm of 1938.
Right. That was a great description of what a tree that's been blown down looks like. And so it's more, you know, we hear the term root ball, and if we go into the nursery and we buy a tree to plant, we have this notion that the roots are just this little ball. But in fact, in the woods, or even as a yard tree, that the root system is more like a dinner plate. It's a big, extended, flat plate. And so when that goes up, when a tree goes over, then you've really wrenched an awful lot out of the ground. And so any rock or any soil that is attached to those roots, and those roots cling so well to the soil, all of that then gets deposited to the side. So it's like you took an excavator and you dug a hole and you just piled the stuff right next to it. And so any place that a tree goes down, that's what you get. So in 38, the wind was from the southeast, and so most of these pits and mounds will be aimed to the northwest. And the way that you can tell which direction a tree fell is you stand in the pit and you look out over the mound, and you know that you're looking in the direction that the tree fell. So the wind was at your back and it took that tree over. So if you're seeing that on gentle slopes or flattish ground, you're seeing that the pits and mounds indicate that it was a southeast wind, then you probably had, that's damage from the hurricane, almost guaranteed.
And you mention in the book that it's, you know, often a half acre or more. It's not one tree that fell, but you can see these sort
of... Yeah, the domino effect.
Yeah.
So one tree would knock another one down, and it was just devastating to see these forests leveled. So you'd have forests that had been 80-foot tall trees, suddenly all of the mass of that forest is within 10 feet of the ground. It's just a vertical forest has become horizontal, and it was just stunning to people.
Well, and we're talking millions of board feet of lumber here. So what happened to all of those trees that were felled?
Well, that's a great question. So so you have a tremendous amount of wood on the ground, both so you've got treetops and you've got logs. The treetops, people were concerned that suddenly there was a potential for a tremendous follow-up disaster with fire. They just thought, oh my God, we've got just all this tinder in place. And then you've got all of these logs that are lost value for the people who owned them. And so the Roosevelt administration, through the Forest Service, swept into New England and really helped coordinate the effort with all the state forestry divisions. And so basically they had a two-pronged approach. They were very interested in reducing the fire risk, and regaining the capacity to fight fire. So you couldn't get into the interior woods because all the trails were covered. And so you couldn't, you know, you wanted to be able to fight fire in and around towns. And so removing brush was really, really important. So that was the one side of things. And then the salvage was the other. So the salvage, because there was such a glut of wood, if you just let market forces play out, nobody would have been paid a penny for their wood because you could get it anywhere. And so the federal government, the New Deal, they set up a new program called the Northeast Timber Salvage Administration, and that administration agreed to purchase logs. So they would purchase logs that were delivered to them. They weren't buying stumpage. They weren't getting in the logging business, but they were buying logs. And so they agreed to do that. And so across New England, there was almost 700 different concentration yards set up to receive these logs. And then about 200, 250 of those, I believe, were ponds. And so they were wet sites where you could put pine logs and it would just sit there and you didn't have to saw it right away. Because if you didn't get to it right away, it would stain. It gets something called blue stain, or insects could get in and damage it. So they were very concerned about getting as much of this timber in ponds as soon as they possibly could. And so so there was 2.6 billion board feet down. Now, that's a number that won't mean much to anybody. You'll just think, wow, that's a big number. But if you picture it as a log truck going down the road that you see every day if you're out driving, that log truck probably has about 6,000 board feet in it. So there was 430,000 log trucks full of wood that was on the ground. So it was just tremendous, and it was there all at once. And so the government stepped in, said, we will buy this wood if you deliver it to us, and then we'll just hold on to it, and we'll sell it over time. And so by doing so, they created a market for this wood so that people were able to at least recoup some of the loss that was there on the ground.
Pretty remarkable, you know, trying to salvage what was already still in 1938 a pretty desperate economy, and, you know, finding some way for people to make some money here at the end of the Great Depression out of this storm.
Right.
Let's get another call in from Jim in Norwich. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Steve, for this wonderful book, which I've just started, but I'm not too far into it yet.
Okay, great.
My father ran a sawmill in the 50s and 60s in central Vermont, and I can very vividly remember him taking me out in the woods on the southeast slopes and showing me some of the, you know, residual damage from the hurricane. And he showed me the roots on the white pine trees and explained to me that they had a longer root system on the northwest side, and it was just a natural way that they braced against the prevailing winds, but they had a not much of a root system on the southeast side. And so he said that, you know, a good wind like that would easily blow over the tree because it wasn't used to the wind coming from that direction. And he also explained to me the danger of what he called hurricane logs. And those were logs that were harvested in the 50s and 60s. And from the twisting and turning of the hurricane, they'd go through the saw on the sawmill, and they'd explode and splinter apart and really hurt the sawyer.
Jim, I'm going to stop you there because we're short on time, but Steve, is that stuff that you also discovered in your research and in your knowledge of forests and forestry?
I've never heard the exploding log story. That's new to me. As for the root systems, I mean, the roots in forest trees, I can picture that – it's almost more of a question of they've just faced all of this wind together. So there's this group of trees, this grove of trees, so they all sort of, they help each other against the wind. And so so when a big wind comes and they start to go, then those root systems are definitely compromised, and that's what gave out. Very few trees snapped off, so it wasn't that they broke off at 10 feet high. They were almost all uprooted.
We just have a couple seconds left, but do you still see beyond the landscape lasting effects of the storm of 38, the hurricane?
Oh, sure. Yes, you can definitely, you see it in the pit and mound, and you see it in the the trees that are bent over, trees that were bent from the southeast to the northwest, and they'll start in that direction, and then they right themselves. And so if you see a preponderance of that, that's probably from the hurricane. I guess the thing to remember is that the big wind was from the south and the southeast. And so it affected trees in the opposite direction.
Stephen Long is the author of 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. Thanks so much for talking with us, Steve.
Oh, thank you, Jane. What a treat.
Coming up, another forester tells us how he looks at wildfire risk this spring.
The big question people are always asking me is it going to be a terrible fire year because of having no snow? It's kind of a complicated answer.
Well, we'll sort it out next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont's biggest risk for grass fires and wildfires is in the spring before leaves bud out and vegetation greens up. And this year's lower than average snowpack has us wondering if we should expect a worse than normal spring fire season. There are two people in the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation who keep a close eye on wildland fire risks. Lars Lund watches the southern half of the state, and Dan Dillner watches the northern half. Yesterday, I met Dillner at his office in Essex Junction, and I asked him to describe the conditions he's seeing in the woods right now.
Well, same as everybody else, I'm seeing all this bare ground and what we call fuels. So you might see leaves, you might see dead grass. In my mind, it's fuel. So I'm seeing that potential for fires this time of year is pretty normal. A little bit abnormal, obviously, is not having the snowpack. It's real common in the last several years to have occasional grass fires in March in Addison and Rutland County, Champlain Valley. What is uncommon is having them statewide. So we have, you know, obviously very little snow cover. We are much lower in our snowfall for the winter, although we're really not that much off of normal for precipitation, which includes like melted precipitation. We're only maybe 1 to 3 inches below normal.
So when it comes to the risk of fires and forest fires, explain why having no snowpack at this time of year and very little or no snowpack even in the higher elevations can make such a difference.
Well, I mean, the big question people are always asking me is it going to be a terrible fire year because of having no snow? It's kind of a complicated answer. There's potential to have possibly more fires just because we're having a longer period with before it greens up. By green up, I mean the time where, you know, late May, early June, when the grass greens up, the leaves come out, fire season really dies down. So we're having a longer period with no snow, but also throughout the whole state. Having said that, it really depends on the weather at that time. You know, if we get into rainy spell, it doesn't matter. So there's potential of possibly having more fires, but it's certainly not us predicting that we're going to have a catastrophic fire season. Just getting back from meeting with the National Weather Service, it looks like we're going to be in a period where we're going to be a little bit warmer than normal temperatures and a little bit above precipitation for the next week or two. And then throughout April, it looks like it's going to be about normal precipitation. So it doesn't look like it's lining up to be a really tremendous fire season, but when we talk about those fine fuels, the grass and leaf litter, it only takes a couple days to dry out. So people are definitely going to need to use caution.
When I go out in the woods near my house in Addison County, at least the last couple of weeks, it has seemed fairly muddy on the trails that I mm-hmm. walk through in the woods, and my yard is very wet. So I can imagine some people saying, wait a minute, it's drier than normal, but I'm still seeing a lot of water in my backyards and my neighborhood. So explain what the state picture is like in terms of how dry it is and how risky it is then to have this period starting so early.
Well, as I said, it's not really drier than normal. It's just not having the snow means that the leaves and the dead grass are not compacted. Okay, so when they're compacted, you can imagine they're not going to burn quite as hot. When they're uncompacted, lots of oxygen around, they're going to burn a little bit better. But yes, you said the ground is wet. It is springtime, it's almost always wet. We don't get the kind of fires in the spring where they're going to burn deep in the ground and be a long-lasting fire. It's going to be grass, you know, leaf litter. It's going to burn quick and hot. Those kind of fires are actually some of the most dangerous fires that we have because things change very quickly. People get caught in that kind of fire. You know, they can take structures down, that kind of stuff. So they're nothing to take lightly, but certainly they're not going to be long-lasting fires. It's not going to go for days and days like a large forest fire you would imagine out west. So the grounds are wet, but still it only takes, we call those one-hour fuels. So it only takes theoretically about an hour for grass from the time it was wet under good drying conditions with, you know, a breeze, sunshine, low humidities for those fuels to be ready to burn. Yeah, they can definitely be dangerous.
I understand one of the other issues this year is usually you have a higher risk for fires at a lower elevation at one time of the year, and then when the snowpack melts at higher elevations, you have the higher risk of fire up higher then. And so you have a little bit of an ability to spread out your resources.
Yeah, what that's a normal occurrence is where we'll have fire danger in the valleys. The hills will be still in snow. Then by the time the valleys green up, then it might be fire danger. So fire season goes from, say, end of March all the way into beginning of June, but not the whole state at one time. That's why we rarely put a statewide burning ban on, because it makes no sense if the Northeast Kingdom has deep, heavy snowpack to have a burning ban on there. So we would do it regionally, or local fire wardens can put their own burning ban on in their town anytime that's needed. You know, in Vermont, the fires are initially attacked by your local volunteer fire department. The state forestry doesn't do initial response to fires. We're a support. We do trainings. We help run the forest fire warden program. We do. We help them get equipment. We will help assist if requested, but they're the ones that do the initial attack.
Is there a statewide fire ban right now?
No, there's no statewide fire ban. So in Vermont, if you want to do open burning of legal materials, which essentially means natural vegetation, doesn't mean you can tear a house down and burn the lumber. If you want to burn clean, natural vegetation, sticks, leaves, that kind of thing, if there's no snow on the ground, you need a permit from your local fire warden. And they don't have to give a permit if they think that it's unsafe.
But you are concerned and want people to know about this risk of fires and forest fires and brush fires. So what are you trying to get people to understand about the conditions and the risk right now?
Well, the important thing is that they understand that they need to get a permit. We have a new website that clearly shows what the fire danger is every day. So when they call to get a burning permit from their local fire warden and the fire warden says no, you know, they can maybe understand that it's not a good idea. This time of year, burning, unless it's raining or has just rained, probably, you know, is not a great plan with all the dead grass and that kind of stuff around. It's very easy for it to escape. Last year, we had several structures burned, a bunch of outbuildings that were destroyed, a couple of houses that were damaged. So it can happen.
You mentioned that you were at a meeting today, Wednesday, as we tape this interview, about forest fires and that you were meeting with the National Weather Service. Was that just to gain a sense of what might be coming down the pike this spring in terms of weather conditions, or were you also looking at other issues?
Now, every year we meet with the National Weather Service. They have a fire weather program. The forestry kind of monitors the fuels. National Weather Service monitors the weather. So that's how you get fire danger. You got to have the fuels, the dryness of the fuels, and the right weather. So we meet every year with all emergency managers in Vermont, U.S. Forest Service, emergency manager in New York, New York Forest Rangers. We have a great partnership with them.
Is the biggest concern in Vermont brush fires? Because, you know, many hikers will recognize the old fire towers along mountains in Vermont, but we don't think of this region as a place that's particularly susceptible to big forest fires like there are out west.
Yeah, it's definitely not as much as out west. To get those catastrophic fires that race across the landscape and, you know, crown fires, it's probably going to be more in an area that has mostly just softwoods. You know, like up in northern Maine. Northeast Kingdom has the potential, but it often is too wet.
So you see a need for
fire tower lookouts again sometime in the future?
Probably not. I mean, those were built in a day where there was a lot of different things going on around the turn of the century, around 1900. We had some huge fires in Vermont. Part of it was after a century of land clearing. So we had, you know, huge areas where they were deforested. So the water, instead of being held in the forest, was running off. We had some drought, so we had mountains of slash and brush and dead tops of trees that were just hanging around. We also had no forest fire warden program, so people could basically burn and do what they wanted, and there were almost no local volunteer fire departments. So it was sort of a whole bunch of things going on at once. You know, now with plenty of aircraft, lots of people with cell phones, I don't think we really need to do that. But New Hampshire still has fire towers, Maine still has fire towers, and occasionally they put people up there.
Dan, is there anything else we should know about the risk of fire danger in Vermont right now?
Well, I mean, every year, you know, as soon as the snow melts, before it greens up, we have a risk of fires. And some years we only have a few, like maybe 98 to 100 fires. Some years it can be over 200. It really depends on what we get for weather. But, you know, if one message I can give out is to people is to, you know, use common sense and get a permit before you do any burning. Because you're not going to get the permit if the fire danger is high, and you'll be all set.
That's Protection Forester Dan Dillner with the Department of Forests, Parks, and Recreation. He says 99% of wildland fires in Vermont are caused by people burning brush or garbage, usually without a permit, and it escapes their control. He says lightning or other causes are extremely rare. Last year, 124 fires burned nearly 400 acres in Vermont. Dillner also mentioned a website that shows fire risk on any given day. We posted a link to that site on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. What did you accomplish when you were 12 years old? Wesley Stockin is that age, and he's already doing something pretty darn cool. He's in sixth grade and lives in Hanover, New Hampshire. When time allows away from his schoolwork, he whips up batches of ice cream to donate to the food pantry at the Upper Valley Haven in White River Junction. VPR's Rick Singeri visited Wesley on a recent school break to learn how he makes ice cream for others.
Two cups of heavy cream. And then I pour it into the bowl that we put all the ingredients in. And then the whole milk. And then a couple drops of vanilla. 3/4 a cup of sugar. There we go. We get the blender. And we just put it in the cylinder. I usually turn it on and then I put all the ingredients in.
We mainly make vanilla and peppermint, but at some point we tried Cherry Garcia, but that didn't quite work, mainly with the cherries. It all turned into one gooey mess.
While it's blending, I pound some peppermint. Usually about a half an hour after I put all the ingredients in the machine, not including the peppermint, about a half an hour after I start putting those all in, I put the peppermint in.
My name is Jennifer Fontaine, the Director of Community Services and Operations here at The Haven. People are thrilled. It's definitely a luxury item that we obviously can't purchase or have here. I mean, everyone loves ice cream, but it's not necessarily something that's in their budget either. So to know that there's a special treat that they can take home, I think ice cream is one of those comfort foods. So it's something nice people don't expect, and so they're thankful to come and be able to get food, but then they're even happier when they can get ice cream.
I'm Wesley's mother, Mary Beth Stockin. We saw one lady, I think it was her first time to check in at the Haven, and she just looked completely defeated. And she had two little girls with her, and she was checking in, and they were explaining the program and what food she was allowed to take and such. I said, "Ma'am, my son just brought a dozen pints of ice cream. If you hurry, you can go get some for your daughters. And she looked at me and her whole face lit up. She said, we haven't had ice cream all summer.
I think it's cool to see their face and to see how, like, sometimes it never even makes it to the freezer because it's, like, something that people, like, really enjoy.
That's Wesley Stockin. He's a sixth grader at the Cardigan Mountain School and lives in Hanover, New Hampshire. Rick Singeri produced that piece, and yes, he most definitely sampled and can attest to the deliciousness of Wesley's peppermint ice cream. The Democratic gubernatorial race picked up another candidate this week. Former State Senator Peter Galbraith says he wants to bring a progressive voice to this contest. Among his top issues, moving forward with single-payer health care, raising the minimum wage immediately, and banning industrial wind projects. We'll hear from Galbraith tomorrow on the program, and if you have a question for him, write to vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance today from Sarah Matthews. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.